It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll find out why old school arcades are making a comeback in Milwaukee. First, there's a new proposal to give healthy eating discounts to people who use food stamps. A bill co-sponsored by Republicans and Democrats in the state legislature would create a pilot program that would give up to half off on fresh produce. The effort has gotten backing from health and advocacy groups who have said it makes healthier eating more accessible. State Representative Mike Rorcast is a co-sponsor of that bill. He's a Republican from Neenah and represents Wisconsin's 55th district. Representative Rorcast, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
How would your healthy savings bill encourage food stamp recipients, you think, to change the way they eat?
Well, what it does is it offers discounts for fresh fruits and vegetables. So it an argument about why sometimes people won't buy fruits and vegetables when they have food stamps is that they can be more expensive than buying other processed foods. So what this does, though, is this provides a discount of, for example, they might get half off of certain fruits and vegetables that are being promoted for this particular program.
And if the bill passed, it sounds like a 10-month pilot program would go into effect that would give these discounts for foods. Tell me a little bit more about the structure. How would it come together?
Well, we would Department of Health Services would find a particular vendor, and there are companies that can do this. There's one company brought it to our attention. And the basically how it works is they would provide what's called a healthy savings card. And when the individual who had food stamps, if they're participating in the pilot, and this would be voluntary for food stamp participants or recipients to participate, then they would take this card and they could use it at checkout. And it would provide them actually two things, but again, it depends on the vendor. But for example, it could tie into actually manufacturer's coupons on what's considered healthier food choices. But then also, this is where the added part of the bill comes in. It would give discounts of, let's say, 50% on certain fruits and vegetables, which would then extend their food share dollars so they could actually purchase more with this discount. And that's where the state is actually then would be refunding the participating retailer. A number of stores are interested. Woodman's is interested. Quick Trip. Festival, so the vendor would have to work with the chains to be participate in this program.
How do you decide what a healthy food is? Some of it seems obvious, a carrot or an apple, a bag of spinach. But if you're talking about, you know, lean protein, some people might consider steak and broccoli healthy or a lobster tail. So how do you figure that part out?
Sure. Well, this is, I mean, where the discounts is specifically on fresh fruits and vegetables. So it would not, the other part of the card, is depending again on the vendor that DHS would choose, could actually provide coupons on healthier choice. Could be leaner meats, could be like frozen certain leaner meats, chicken, et cetera, that could be considered healthy. You do bring up a good point, though. That is the hardest thing to kind of determine what is healthy, what isn't healthy. Again, though, the most important part of this bill is encouraging and incentivizing actually for people to purchase fresh fruits and vegetables. That's really where that's the focus of what we want the pilot to determine if that's really going to change people's buying habits. We believe that it will, but obviously we need to prove that out.
One sticking point for anybody eating healthfully is that there has been some data out there showing that it costs more to buy the
Correct.
Fresh stuff. Do you think this will do enough to move that healthy stuff you want people to be choosing more of into a more affordable zone?
Well, again, it does give them a discount, and that's, again, why we're doing the pilot. We believe that hopefully it will. I think that if they can incorporate more fresh fruits, vegetables into their meal program or their meals that they have at home, then they can start to learn how to utilize those fresh fruits and vegetables to maybe extend their food budget even further down the road as well. So again, this is a pilot program. It's trying to encourage and actually incentivize. And again, it stretches their dollars. So hopefully it will help to address that issue of where these can cost more money. They also have a shorter shelf life than canned fruits and vegetables as well.
Now, what would you say to critics who might feel that the government is playing too much of a hand in the decision that people on welfare make, like the kind of food that they buy in this case?
Well, I guess I would look at this from a couple of different perspectives. When you look at the cost of health care, the root cause of a lot of health care cost is unhealthy eating habits of everybody, whether they're on food stamps or not. Companies that have their own health care benefits and plans, they do these kinds of incentives for their employees right now, where they do provide connections, sometimes discounts or incentives for those employees to participate in healthy behaviors because they know that it'll lead to lower health care costs in the long run. Why shouldn't we be doing the same with state benefit programs that are being given to individuals, particularly when we're not forcing them to do this? We're only incentivizing, and actually by doing it, they're, again, like I've mentioned, they're able to stretch these dollars or these the food share benefits even further.
We're talking to State Representative Mike Rohrkast right now. He's a Republican from Neenah and represents Wisconsin's 55th District, talking about a new bill that he sponsored, the Healthy Savings Bill, that would give food stamps recipients discounts on healthy food. There are a number of organizations that are in support of this bill. What have they said about why they like it?
Well, it's, again, it's getting back to promoting a healthier food choices. When you look at some of the highest cost and the, maybe the most prevalent health issues that we have, whether it's heart disease or diabetes, that is often caused by not eating in the best way possible. So, again, this is, I think, so like the American Heart Association, they've come out in support of this bill because in their view, and studies have shown, that eating more fresh fruits, vegetables, versus other foods that can cause heart issues, they think that this is a good thing.
Have you talked at all to people who would be receiving the benefit? Is this something that they're looking for?
Well, and that's something that would be part of the pilot program, that we would have to identify people that would be willing and interested in doing this. And I think that's actually, many people, I think, have said that they would like to purchase more fruits and vegetables, but as you mentioned before, they can be more expensive. So now, if we're giving them a discount, hopefully that this will give them that incentive to do it. And we are going to try to provide this pilot opportunity to people that are very interested. Some people are going to be more interested in their own health than others, and I mean that applies to everybody. I mean, a comment just for people on food share benefits. Everybody, some people will pay more attention, but we are going to want to try to help those individuals that are interested in improving their eating habits.
Now, food stamp benefits have been controversial in the past, especially after an initiative in Wisconsin that would allow for drug testing of some recipients. What is your vision or your hope for programs that provide public assistance?
Well, I guess when you look at drug testing, to me, the key thing, if somebody is on state benefit and they are, the goal of whenever you're on state benefits, whether it's food share benefits, unemployment benefits, is to hopefully get that person gainfully employed. And where drug testing becomes important is if they are actually looking for work, then many employers drug test. So part of being what's called ready and able to work is the ability to pass a drug test. So I do think that drug testing, particularly for unemployment benefits and people that have unemployment, they could be receiving food share benefits as well. But if they're out looking for work, then I do think it's appropriate to test because they may be limited in terms of employment opportunities. And also, when we've talked about doing this, the important thing is we have to provide help for individuals if they do have an issue with any kind of illegal substances, so that we help get them to where they will pass a drug test, because that's the point. We want to get people back to work and be able to get off of state benefits at some point in time by either getting to work or getting better employment.
Do you see a future where there would be more than job support, but other structural changes to help support people when they have that job?
I think there is actually some other structural changes that we need to be making. Right now, like with, let's say, with Medicaid, which for Badger Care, the way that sometimes the federal rules work is that once a person hits a certain level of income, then they completely lose that benefit. We would like to see that phased out. So in other words, we want to provide an encouragement for people to make more, but not necessarily take all of their state benefits away. In other words, ease those benefits down as they start to make more money, and then hopefully they'll be able to not need that state benefit. So there's some inherent problems. Some of it's federally driven. I would love to continue to work on that, as I know a number of people both on both sides of the aisle would like to try to do, because, again, the point is trying to encourage people, I think, with incentives, reasons to look for either employment, better employment, ways to stretch their dollars better.
Representative Roarkast, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
State Representative Mike Roarkast is a Republican from Neenah. He represents Wisconsin's 55th district. He joined us to talk about a bill he's co-sponsoring that would discount healthy foods for people who use food stamps in Wisconsin. If you're an older millennial or Gen Xer, the sound might be music to your ears. The sound, of course, of Ms. Pac-Man might take a lot of people back. The iconic 80s arcade game featured a character that earned points by eating little pellets and avoiding swiftly moving ghosts. The game eventually made its way to more advanced consoles like Atari and even to people's cell phones. Well, Ms. Pac-Man might see a rise in popularity again because the old-school arcades that made the game famous are coming back. Michael Sampson is the owner of an 80s-themed arcade that will be opening soon in Milwaukee. It's called 1983. He's one of several business owners in Milwaukee that are making low-tech games cool again. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Now, you're about to open a retro arcade in Milwaukee. What do you think the appeal is of playing old games from the 80s when we have such high-tech stuff available today?
Yeah, I think it's just... generates with a lot of the older millennials, kind of your 26 to 35 year olds, that these are the games that they grew up playing. And you know, when I was a kid, I'd go to arcades and in malls, or more restaurants had them back then, kind of something for kids to do while your parents were busy shopping or eating. So I think it just kind of resonates with that 25 to 35 year old age group.
Now, I'm older. I can't believe I'm admitting this on the air, but I'm older than 35, and I love these are the games of my childhood, too. Are you seeing Gen Xers in there?
That's a good thing. I don't really know where I classify. I think I'm an older millennial / Gen Xer, so I can relate with you as well, Veronica.
Well, give us a sense of what some of the games from this era are and, you know, what the point of them is, because they're simpler. The goals seem to be a little different than what I see my kids playing today.
Yeah, I can't believe some of the games that are coming out today and how realistic they look. But some of the ones that we're bringing in, NBA Jam's a favorite. Some of the fighting games like X-Men, Super Mario Brothers, obviously Donkey Kong, Pac-Man, Double Dragon, a lot of those early NES games.
Now, you did not list my favorite game, the best game, which you have to have, Galaga.
Galaga, we've already announced, and it's going to be there. My one of my employees, Kelsey, that's her favorite, so she demanded it.
It's really good. We have a few of them in the neck of the woods where I live. They always seem to be broken, though. How do you maintain these old video games?
So I'm partnering with a company in West Dallas called Mitchell Novelties, and they have just warehouses and warehouses full of these games. So they kind of maintain and repair and just fix all the machines for me as needed.
What do you hear about the appeal of these games? Why do people want to play them? Is there something soothing almost, do you think, about them, playing something that's so low-tech?
I think so. I think in today's busy world and how fancy your phones are and everything these days, I think it kind of is relaxing to sit down and just play an old game that you just kind of turn your brain off and, you know, just play something that resonated with you in your childhood.
Did you ever play the game Q-Bert?
Yes.
So Q-Bert is a pretty simple game. The little guy hops around on these cubes and tries to not get eaten by the snake. It almost seems, you know, at first blush, it seems like this is not going to be fun anymore. We've been exposed to such more advanced technology when it comes to our gaming. that these games are not going to hold our attention. But do you think they have the potential, you know, not just to be sort of a kitschy thing for millennials, but do you think there's a potential for younger generations to get into them too?
Yeah, I think so. That's the excitement. Our location is directly across from the new Bucks Arena going in. So I'm really hoping that, you know, a father and a son or a mother can go to a game with their child and kind of swing by the arcade before or after the game and kind of show them a game that they grew up playing, and hopefully their child will be excited about it as well.
Now, you said this was something that you had done, playing these retro arcade games. What was the vibe like in the arcades that you went to?
I specifically remember going to the Oregon Piper Pizza on Highway 100 back in the day, and it was a lot larger of an arcade then from what they cut down since then and just kind of have a back room. But just that craze of in the early 80s, mid-80s of the arcade, these were big times for those big cabinets and arcades back in the day. So it was kind of sad to see them go away and kind of die off in a lot of the locations, but it's exciting to see them come back now.
Do you think that on the business end of things, is this a money-making proposition, or is it going to be more about the drinks that you sell? Because these games are only a quarter, you know, token for you, but a quarter is something you can make money on?
Yeah, I mean, like any bar, you know, your money is in the drink sales. So, you know, hopefully people are drinking some beer and cocktails as you're playing, and, you know, every additional revenue, I think, would come hopefully from corporate parties. I've already been reached out by a couple corporations that want to kind of rent the space out during the week. So I think that's a big market as well.
Now, the arcade you're planning, we've been talking about, is called 1983. And this is a significant year. How come?
1983 is the year that Nintendo was released in Japan, and also the year I was born.
Have you heard from people about why they're excited about something like this in Milwaukee?
Yeah, I think Milwaukee's always had that. It's always been a good market for games. I mean, Aladdin's Castle used to exist back in the day in some of the malls. And like I said, some bigger places like Oregon Piper would have more cabinets. But just Milwaukee doesn't have this yet. And I do a lot of traveling and have been to some in other cities like Cobra and Phoenix and a couple of them in L.A. and the original arcade in New York. And they're always pretty busy with people, and people are excited to be there, and we're excited to bring this concept to Milwaukee.
Now, the music from these retro arcade games is one of its signatures, I think. You hear more cinematically scored stuff today, but these old-school retro arcade music themes, they're really fun. Do you have a favorite?
You always love the classic Mario theme when you hear it, so I really enjoy hearing that still. But just those scores from those video games are even coming back in more pop culture. When you watch Stranger Things, which I think comes out this weekend, you know, they have those kind of old 80s scores of either video games or 80s music that I think are really kind of coming back in the popular scene, along with 80s and 90s parties and other things like that, because everyone is that age now that, you know, they can drink and have fun with those things.
We're talking to Michael Sampson right now. He's the owner of an 80s-themed arcade that's going to be opening soon in Milwaukee. It's called 1983, one of several business owners in Milwaukee that are turning to low-tech, older video games from the 80s. And, Michael, I was thinking about the way we're really in the golden age of television right now. And one of the signatures of this era is that we have these incredibly extended storylines. And the stories themselves are rich and immersive. And these 80s games are kind of the opposite. They're short. You, like we were talking about, you put your quarter in, you play for a few minutes, and it's done. Nothing extends beyond that. Why do you think that appeals? Because in a way, it seems like it's going against the grain today.
I think there's deeper and richer storylines in those games as well. There's more simplicity as, say, a Donkey Kong game where Peach is at the top and Mario has to get to the top to kind of rescue her. But there's obstacles and paths along the way, so every game kind of has their own story, just not as extensive as maybe the TV and storylines of today, but there's definitely stories behind those old video games as well.
Yeah, we talked about some of the good ones. We talked about some of the games you're going to have. My favorite, of course, Galaga, the best game. Burger Time is my second. But are there games that you look to and you thought, you know what, this actually isn't fun anymore. This is not a good game, and I'm not going to stock it.
I think each game kind of appeals to different people. I never played Burger Time growing up, but I know a lot of people love Burger Time, so we plan on having that there. Awesome. I also plan on doing a monthly rotation or a bi-monthly rotation of games just to kind of get a fresh game in there. And, you know, hopefully that's someone else's favorite out there. Every game I'm bringing is not going to be one of my favorites. It's just we pulled some people and done some research, so, and traveling the country and seeing what other barcades they're putting out there. So we think we're going to have a good mix of games.
What do you think it was that led to the decline of the old-fashioned arcades that you were talking about?
I mean, computers coming forward was a big thing. In the 80s, the arcades kind of dwindled off. I think when you have these personal systems coming out, like Nintendo and Super Nintendo and Sega Genesis, you just want to be at home playing those as opposed to going out to a bar or an arcade that might have these. So I think that was a huge thing with that. And then obviously with the computers coming out with IBM and Apple and some of those games getting popular in the 90s, that kind of pulled away from the arcades as well.
So any other way that you're thinking about kind of getting that 80s feel into the business you're going to open, 1983?
So I've been researching just some wall art, kind of some 80s movie posters that I've been interested in putting up possibly. And I really want to have one of those laser photo backdrops that kids had, you know, when they take school pictures, so people can take pictures in front of that and people would kind of know that, you know, they're at that bar then.
Oh, that sounds great. Well, it sounds like a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to finding another working Galaga game in the state of Wisconsin. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yes, no problem.
Michael Sampson is the owner of a new 80s-themed arcade called 1983. It's going to be open soon in Milwaukee. Our next guest says aging is harder for women than it is for men. From the pressure to keep looking young to competition that comes from society and even from other women, she says that despite all that, there are ways women can start to feel more positive about getting older. Ashton Applewhite joins us now. She's the author of This Chair Rocks, a manifesto against ageism. She's an activist against discrimination on the basis of ageism. Ashton, welcome to Central Time.
Hi.
Why do you say that aging is harder for women?
Because women face the double whammy of ageism and sexism. We are judged especially harshly on the basis of our appearance, as we all know. You know, how you look and how you look, of course, does matter. But it's in an ageist world, it's considered a problem or a failure to look old. And there's this double standard around aging, that aging, you know, makes those distinguished newscasters, silver-haired dudes, you know, be somehow enhanced by aging while women are devalued by it.
And you also talk about how as women age, in a way, they kind of get invisible. And one idea you had was that women should stop trying to sort of aid that process as you saw it at the time and not color their hair to let it go silver so that they stood out more.
How did that go over? I'm going to get hate mail if you frame it that way. I had a piece in the New York Times last week. When I was naive enough to think that I was being appropriate in speaking like that, I got a ton of blowback. I had this great, because it's not for me to tell any woman, any person, what she should or should not do. We age in our own way, at our own speed, and we each need to make whatever accommodations we need to make to get through life in, you know, in a way that suits us. But I did have this sort of aha moment when I realized, of course, how many, many women dye their hair to cover the gray and don't like doing it. I'm only talking to those of us who experience this as costly and as sort of something demanded from us by society, not something we actually enjoy doing. And when a group, when we do that, we make ourselves invisible as older women. And when a group is invisible, so are the issues that affect us. And I just had this idea of imagine if the world could see how many of us there are, women with gray hair, AKA older women, how many we are and how gorgeous we are. And it would be, and if we could do it together, this year of letting our hair go gray. And I put it on Facebook. I got a ton of blowback for the reason I already referred to. But there's something in there, in the invisibility. in which we collude.
Right. You know? And just to be clear, that's what I was getting at. This idea of being invisible is something I've heard from other women who age, and they say they feel like people stop seeing them. And I don't know if it has anything to do with hair color. And obviously women want to be free to dye their hair if they want to. People have to choose their own way. But what about the invisibility problem? How do we get at that?
Well, the invisibility problem is, again, really complicated, and it's hard to talk about it without appearing judgmental. So I really want to say, again, no judgment about dyeing your hair, about Botox, about fudging your resume, because those strategies are often really necessary to maintain your place in an ageist world. The problem is that they give a pass to the discrimination that makes the behaviors necessary. When a lot of our self-esteem is based on how we look, and in particular, to frame it in heteronormative terms, in whether we get men's attention, then if to age is to become ugly and men no longer look at us, we experience becoming invisible. So part of the issue, part of the challenge, is to look at ourselves differently and to stop valuing ourselves in terms of whether we conform to some punishing cultural standard, in which, of course, we all need to be thin, of course, and we all need to be beautiful, and we all need to be young. We cannot stay young. The way the system is set up now is that women compete against each other to see who can stay young or look younger. And you don't need a PhD in feminist studies to realize that doing that reinforces the idea that how you look is the most important thing about you, reinforces ageism because it promotes the idea that that older is worse than younger and old equals ugly. And it reinforces patriarchy, of course, because it's the standard model where women compete. I mean, another example is stay-at-home moms competing against moms who work outside the home about who's a better parent, when we should be joining forces to close the wage gap. As long as women compete to stay young, it sets us up to fail, and it pits us against each other. And we are so much harsher judges of our own appearance than men are. I mean, I can't tell you how many stories I've heard of women who say, I wanted to go gray, but my mom said, no, don't do that. Or I went gray and my friends all said, gee, you know, you look older. Are you sure you want to do that? You should start dyeing it again. It's not typically men who say that.
We're talking to Ashton Applewhite right now. She's the author of This Chair Rocks. She writes at thischairrocks.com and is the author of This Chair Rocks, A Manifesto Against Ageism. And we're talking about what happens as women age. Ashton has some ideas about how women can claim their power and keep it going as they get older. And Ashton, one of the things you write about, you say, is we need to learn to look more generously at one another and at ourselves.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I quote, the article came out with a picture of Frances McDormand, whom I'm a big fan of, and she points to a wrinkle on her face and credits her son for that wrinkle for every time she went, oh, yippee, or oh, my God. You know, that looking, I mean, if you think about just the simple fact that we get wrinkles from laughing and smiling. So what does it say about a culture that urges us to eliminate, you know, the map of our experience? I understand that this is a really big ask, but I also know that it feels right and it feels natural, you know. And so one of the things I'm asking people, women, to do is to be, we know this from the body positivity movement, right? That as long as we're struggling to all be a size six, you know, and have everything perfect, we're never content with ourselves. And the real satisfaction lies in looking at yourself more generously, seeing that you are beautiful the way you are, and not spending tons of money and tons of effort trying to conform to some standard that maybe a few supermodels can make, but even they, they're going to get old, and then they're going to be depressed, and so on. It's a loser's game. It also has a tremendous class bias because that stuff is expensive, and again, it pits us against each other.
And part of what you're talking about there is getting a quorum of women, a community of women, to start thinking differently. Do you think that's happening?
You know, I'm not nuts. I know it's a really big ask, but I also know that it feels right. I know we know this from a lot of you know, work on ourselves from the body positivity movement. I think it's huge that Allure magazine in August, it's the issue that's I think still on the newsstands, bans the term anti-aging from its pages. Now, the next sentence in the editorial is like an ad for some, you know, youth-enhancing product. We've got a long way to go, but I really do think we know from the women's movement, you know, that being discriminated against on the basis of something about ourselves that we can't change, and from the civil rights movement, and from the disability rights movement, you know, that there is no room in an equitable world for judging people on the basis of their skin color, their body size, whether they're in a wheelchair, and so on. To hitch age to that, you know, and to that wagon, if you will, and insist that age is a criterion for diversity as well, is I think the culture's ready for it, and I think it is absolutely happening. And, you know, women face this double whammy in all kinds of ways, in being burdened with more caregiving responsibilities, much of which is welcome, but some of which is not up to us. We just get stuck with it. And, of course, less wages, so women have less income when they get older and are less likely to have a pension at all. If they do, it's smaller. And with employers stop investing in women's careers in their 30s, early 30s, because you might have a baby. And whether or not you have a baby, whether or not you're ever going to have a baby, whether you're straight or gay, all women face this kind of structural discrimination, and we need to join forces against all of it. And with women of color, we need to make, you know, all these struggles are united, and we need to put them all in our sights, because, you know, there's a great quote by a poet named Audre Lorde. She says, there's no such thing as a single-issue struggle because we don't lead single-issue lives. When we make the world a better place to grow old in, we make it a better place in which to be a woman, to be a person of color, to have a disability, and so on down the line.
Ashton Applewhite stays with us. She's the author of This Chair Rocks, A Manifesto Against Ageism. And you can join us. Why do you think getting older is tough on women? Do you ever feel invisible as you age? And how do you embrace the stage of life that you're in, the age that you are? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Ashton Applewhite is here with us now. She's the author of This Chair Rocks, A Manifesto Against Ageism. She's an activist against discrimination on the basis of age. And you can join us. What do you think about this? If you're a woman, do you find that as you get older, it's tougher to feel good about yourself? Do you feel pressure from society to stay young? And how do you deal with that? How do you cope and create a community that's supportive and values who you are at any age? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Ashton, let's get to another one of your suggestions. You suggest that we tap into what we know, that getting older enriches us.
It does. I mean, if you want evidence of that, how about the fact that no one, no matter how terrified they might be about getting old, actually wishes to be any younger? If, you know, unless you could take your present-day consciousness back with you in time, which, of course, we cannot. We know that, you know, I am not a Pollyanna about aging. There are real challenges that are totally legitimate. But I want to make the case for telling both sides of the story, that while there are losses, there are all kinds of gains. We contain all the ages and people we have been along the way, and that knowledge and those experiences remain accessible to us. It is additive as well. So, and you know, for lots of women, I mean, even this loss of sort of visibility is how some women experience it, find that really liberating. One thing that is universal to aging just about is more confidence. You're more comfortable in your own skin, figuratively and literally. And, you know, all of those, I mean, it's hugely liberating. And lots of older women find, if they, you know, are are freer of the day-to-day demands of caregiving, find it, and society's expectations of them, find it a lot of fun, actually. I mean, I don't know, you know, talk to your friends and tap into yourself. I think it's a pretty universal experience despite living in an ageist culture, and imagine how much even more positive that would be if we didn't live in a culture that tries to drown out all the positive.
Let's go to a caller now at 800-642-1234 as we talk about how women can push back against anti-ageism in our culture. And let's go to Suzette in Greenfield. Suzette, hi.
Hi. The point that I want to make is that socially, I have no problem with aging, with friends or activities or anything, but it's in the workplace that I feel really, I really feel the pressure. I'm 57, and I just don't feel that there's any more opportunities for me to, like, climb, you know, the ladder at work anymore. And people, you know, young ones say to me, so when are you going to retire? I'm not even thinking about that.
Suzette, thanks a lot for that, for sharing that. And Ashton, what comes to mind as you hear Suzanne sharing her experience right now?
That's a great call. Thank you, Suzanne. And the original title for this whole project was called So When Are You Going to Retire? Because it's something people get asked so often. That is a totally ageist thing to say, as you know, because that's how you hear it. And a really good all-purpose answer to something like that is just, why would you say that? And then let that uncomfortable pause hang in the air, because then, you know, and then see how the person answers. And what is up, because you're 57, I mean, they may or may not know how old you are, and congratulations for saying it out loud on the air without flinching, because we need to own it at the same time that we push back against exactly what you're bridling about, the idea that 57 means that you're on your way out. The longer we live, the more different from one another we become, and the less someone's age tells you about what someone is interested in or capable of, you know. So I think what you want to do is just ask that open-ended question and see what they say, and try and push back against any of the stereotypical assumptions they might be making about you on the basis of your age, and get them, see if you can jog them into realizing that, you know, would they say make a similar comment on the basis of your skin color? You know, no, they wouldn't.
Suzette, thanks a lot for that. Really appreciate your call. And we go next to Maddie joining us from Black River Falls. Maddie, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
And for myself, I'm always grateful and very thankful every morning. I say a thank you for another day of learning something, possibly being able to hand someone else information that I learned through the years. I'm approaching 80 in a few days, and my time that I can spend doing things for other people or volunteering and just enjoying every day that's there is wonderful. And when some people say, oh, you know, they're approaching a certain age, they're over the hill. Well, for myself, I think it's much better than being under the hill, as far as I know. And it just, life is beautiful, even if it's a rainy, cloudy day like it is here today. But there's so much to be thankful for, and I would love to have a lot more years ahead of me than what I have behind me. And everybody should be so thankful for whatever limitations they have, even if they're physical or mental. To be thankful gets you through an awful lot.
Maddie, thank you so much. Beautifully said. And Ashton, gratitude for each day.
And beautifully said. You know, we in this culture, we look at age through the lens of loss alone. And what we lose as we age is more visible than what we gain, although the gains are equally real, of course. And it's so easy to underestimate the quality of life of an older person or a person with a disability. What we hear from the caller and so many other people is that we adapt to changes in our lives, and it doesn't mean that a life that might be more constrained physically or even cognitively isn't absolutely worth living, and that the view from the inside is different. I mean, I had tons of ageist assumptions when I started this project, one of which was that, older people must be depressed because it's awful to be old, as we know, and you're going to die soon. And so why wouldn't they be? Older people enjoy better mental health than the young or middle-aged. The longer people live, the less they fear dying. And people are happiest at the beginnings and the ends of their lives. Google U-curve of happiness if you don't believe me. And that is the case across cultures, around the world, across financial status and health status. And again, imagine what that curve would look like. It shows life like the smile on a happy face, you know, happiest in childhood and into our 80s. What would that curve look like if we didn't live in a culture that bombarded us with messages that it's sad to be old and that old people have little to contribute?
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Do you think we have enough role models? When I think about older women that I see being celebrated in the media, usually what I hear commentators saying is, oh, she looks fabulous. Doesn't she look great? Instead of, you know, what is she contributing? What is she doing? What has she done?
Well, what's the most important thing? How we look, right? You know, that's totally not okay. I think there are millions of role models out there doing fantastic things. I would like less of the emphasis to be on how you look, let alone how you look for your age, which is an incredibly ageist thing to say. You would never say, you know, you look great for a woman. So, again, analogies to other prejudices are useful in figuring out what's ageist and what isn't. There are lots of women out there. I also think it's really important to celebrate people, men and women alike, who are not necessarily curing cancer or jumping out of airplanes, but simply meeting each day with generosity and equanimity, like the woman who just called. She's a hero, too.
And again, thank you, Maddie, for that call. And Ashton, as we wrap up now, we've got about 30 seconds left. Leave us with one or two positive thoughts that we can start with, or actions we can take.
I just left you with a lot of them. I urge women of all ages to come together and talk about aging, because we're very age segregated in society and we don't talk about this stuff. Younger women would be less fearful if they learned about, you know, what it's like to be older, and older women, I think, would be less resentful because we would make friends. It is really, really important as we age, men or women, to make and hold on to friends of all ages. And of course, when we do that, ageism dismantles itself, because it's really hard to hold on to stereotypes when you have friends of all ages or all colors or whatever, who clearly, obviously, don't conform to stereotypes because they don't exist.
Ashton, thank you for that. And in looking forward to what we can expect, you think things are getting better. You think that we're ready for this. You see signs that things are changing.
I think we know that diversity is here to stay and that it's a good thing, and that to incorporate age as a criterion for diversity is a very small ask. I have it, you know, it's not always on the list, but when I say to people, you know, what do you think of criteria for diversity? How about age? Nobody says that's a dumb idea. They all go, duh, obviously. So I think we have a very short leap to add to this, you know, broader social consciousness and awareness that is already well underway.
Ashton, thanks a lot for being with us.
You're very welcome.
Ashton Applewhite is the author of This Chair Rocks, a manifesto against ageism. She's an activist against discrimination on the basis of age. And we're talking about how women can feel empowered as they age and can push back against the anti-aging stigma that women face. And you can let us know what you think. How do you empower yourself? And how do you look at the world as you get older? Let us know over on the Central Time Facebook page. Earlier in the show, we talked about the rise of retro video games. It is games from my era, the 80s, and there's a handful of new 80s arcades opening in Milwaukee. And Central Time producer Chris Molina is here to talk about something that we share, which is a love of the game Galaga, which is really, Chris, let's be fair, it's more my era than yours, but we have what you call a friendly rivalry here.
Friendly rivalry is a good way of putting it. Now, for the better part of the last 4 years, you and I have kind of been taunting each other over who's the better Galaga player, but we've never actually settled this, which is something that we're going to have to do in the near future, which I worry that once we actually do, this friendly rivalry may turn into a not-so-friendly rivalry, depending on how competitive you are. Are you pretty competitive?
It depends on how sore a loser you are, Chris.
Whoa.
That's what it depends on.
Now, my question for you is, so anyone who's played Galaga will know you can go for the second jet fighter, or you could not go for the second jet fighter. Do you go for the second one?
Of course, you have to. You have to have the second jet fighter to get to the higher levels, right?
Exactly. But then, you kind of play the risk-reward sort of thing when you get a little further on. So I always go for it, and it usually pays off, and I hope it's going to pay off again when we finally have this the showdown that we've been talking about.
I know, we need to make this happen. And do you shoot all of, I call them the space puppies, the little three big, do you try to shoot all three, or do you just let them go?
The ones that kind of split off at the same time, yeah, you got to go for them all at once, otherwise they're going to come back and they're going to hurt you later.
All right, we have to settle this, but Chris, thank you for coming in and talking Galaga.
Thanks, Veronica.
You're listening to Central Time.